Hi, this is Stephanie Halleck. I am a professor of political science at Hartford Community College, and I am here today with a section of Honors American National Government. So I have a group of five brilliant students who have done some research this semester that we wanted to share. So I'm going to let everybody introduce themselves and sort of the general topic that they approached, and we will have our conversation from there.
Hi, I'm Megan, and I focus on the American criminal justice system.
Hi, I'm Carson Freeman, and I focused on the American education system.
Hi, I'm Julia Hollowell. My topic is on urbanization and suburbanization and how that creates political apathy and thus polarization.
Hi, my name is Keith, and my topic was the modern-day pacification of the people of the United States.
Hi, my name is Alyssa Henderson, and my topic is gender inequality in the United States compared to the rest of the world.
Okay, thank you, everyone. So, again, the overall thesis that, or the assignment that I gave them in general was to take a look at where we are today as American citizens and where we fit into these structures like education, the criminal justice system, and the relationship really between the individuals and the structures. So one of the things that immediately came to my attention when I was looking through all of their papers was that there was a pretty clear underlying common theme. So Julia, can you tell us a little bit about the theme overall that you saw and how it impacts the attitude of citizens as far as their desire to participate in American democracy?
Yeah, so there are these systemic issues in American power structures, including but not limited to social and economic inequality, racial disparity, and misogyny. So it's not like Americans have not protested against these issues, but nothing changes because those within the power structures who have the authority and ability to change things benefit from the way things currently are. The lack of ethical journalism, the inane distractions of social media, and the rampant drug crisis to numb frustration have further separated American citizens from empowering change.
And Julia, you noted in your paper that one of the factors that separates citizens is the sprawling development of the suburbs. And what I found really interesting about this was that your comment that the rate of development is not actually driven by population growth at all. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
So development has boomed, and this is shown in data, but also you can just see it in your daily life. You can drive around and see new developments popping up everywhere. And, you know, every time that you wonder, why is traffic so bad? Or when did X, Y, and Z town get so busy? You're seeing sprawling development in action. So lobbying groups have played a huge part in this. For example, and this is something that's built over the last 100 years, in like the 1920s, General Motors lobbied for streetcar lines to be just decimated. And instead, they built up buses, and car ownership exploded during this time. And so what that translates to is just thousands of miles of road. Like, for example, again, in the 1920s, this like coalition of, you know, car manufacturers, construction workers, land developers all lobbied Congress for the creation of new highways. And so that's kind of where we are. You know, every action that's taken is done on behalf of large businesses rather than actually what people want.
Excellent. Megan, why is this happening?
Well, I think it's happening because a lot of our leaders in this country have terrible priorities. They tend to focus around greed rather than good of people. And we can see this throughout history as leaders and people in power have chosen control and money over respect and the quality of others' lives. They fail to recognize or care about how their actions are impacting others. We can actually see this through slavery and today with mass incarceration, which has brought money to businesses and allowed people in power to prosper while others are not. They pass legislation and devote resources to maintaining a system that benefits them and clearly not the majority of citizens. Our country continues to change with time, and as we progress and realize that some things aren't right, we try to fix the issue, yet the issue tends to take just a new form to fit where we are in society today. But the problem still generally still exists.
Exactly. And this has led to some pretty outdated processes sticking around. Though lip service may be given to appease protesters, America still operates on the assumption and processes that stem from Jim Crow laws, education for the elite, and dominating the wild land through rampant development proves how advanced we are. And the entire notion of a woman's place is in the home may not be said aloud any longer, but certainly exists in practice. For women who choose to become mothers, the system works against us. Childcare can be like paying an extra rent payment or mortgage per month. In Massachusetts, couples pay an average of 17% of their income just for childcare alone. I've heard of married women quitting their jobs because the cost of childcare would almost eclipse their income, so why work? So they go from a two-income home to one with more mouths to feed. Meanwhile, in many other countries, there is universal childcare. It's free, and these problems don't exist.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the processes for electing representatives to government? Again, outdated processes. We may try to protest those things as well. We see that it has minimal effect on actual policymaking. Is this intentional?
It is, but most importantly, I would argue that election of representatives at any point in American history has done absolutely nothing to rid the core problems of the United States. I mean, when you look throughout American history, it's not as if things have changed whatsoever. And when it first started out, the United States was ruled by, you know, royal corporations. And from there, moved on to slave-owning elites and then American-born corporations. And for that entire time, the elective representatives have only just been figureheads for that core aspect of how America functions.
I feel like there's more related into the systemic processes of the country. A lot of it has its roots in our federalist system, but it comes down to if the government and public services that every individual citizen has access to, if those services aren't proving adequate, the solution lies within the private sector. There's a lot involved there, but the problem is because the nature of our society and how it's set up, there's a lot of inequality of access there. If you're someone who doesn't have wealth, you're pretty much stuck. You don't have access to the things you might need, and that creates a gigantic problem for a pretty good chunk of the population.
Well, the thing about that is that modern America tries to mix together the idea of virtuous egalitarianism, you know, like trying to help everyone and make everyone equal, while simultaneously having a system that promotes a social hierarchy. Part of why that's a problem is because, you know, America as a whole can't decide between supporting the concept of people being poor, rich, middle class, and the idea that everyone is inherently equal. You know, you can't mix those two ideas. It's contradictory.
I think a lot of our system subjects the lower class. So, for example, with my topic, urbanization, suburbanization, in the 1940s and 50s, sections of cities were set off, they were redlined.
And so, Megan, what happened to the people who stayed in the cities?
Well, one of the things that started happening was when laws started to be created over time, a lot of the legislation that was being passed impacted the Black community much more than any other group of people. Because, as Julia mentioned, with the redlining, it separated them. And the Black community ended up in a lot of urban areas, while the white community was in suburban areas. And laws such as with the war on drugs, they created drug-free zones, which, although the legislation passed seemed pretty neutral, it ended up impacting the Black community much more.
So it seems like a lot of these things that you've kind of tackled separately are really quite interconnected, which means unraveling them is not going to be easy. And even if we can do that, addressing one piece of it is going to have a ripple effect on all of the other things. So what can we do about it?
Systemic change in this country is kind of an inherently difficult thing to accomplish because the nature of our two-party system. You can try to accomplish things, and you might get small steps, small victories, but getting that big breakthrough is going to be a big problem because the side that disagrees with you, they're just going to try to gridlock your process. They're going to try to bury you in litigation. It's not going to be something you can just approach like as some type of easy thing. I think the education system process, which I tackled, is an example of that. You look at the past 20 years, we've been tackling the same issue, and we've gone through, what, four or five presidents now, and it's pretty much just been more of the same. There hasn't been any type of definite fix to the problem, just stopgap measures.
Well, one thing we can do is learn lessons from other countries and what they've done well. Like, in terms of female leadership, we are incredibly behind the rest of the world. All over the world, there have been female presidents and female prime ministers, but here in the U.S., we just swore in the first woman into the White House last year. We all have experiences based on our demographics that give us a different perspective on the world. So we need more female representation so that we get that perspective to be heard where decisions are being made. And for women who choose to be mothers in the U.S., they are living in one of the very few countries in the world without paid maternity leave. The average leave around the world is a paid 29 weeks, while here in the U.S., you're lucky to get an unpaid 12 weeks.
And there's science around that, the children, the relationship and what children need and how long it takes a woman to recover from childbirth, right?
Yes, medical research does say mothers need more time off.
So when we talk about structure, and we mean both systemic structure, legal decision, political structure, but we also mean physical infrastructure itself. So why, Keith, don't we fix this?
Well, the issue is that people think that they can fix a broken system through the system itself. You know, trying to solve America's problems through conventional protests and electing officials is like trying to clean out a grease-filled microwave with a grease-covered cloth. You're putting in a lot of effort for nothing at all. And if people actually want to make change instead of just kind of promoting it, you have to stop thinking within the boundaries of conventional politics, and you have to kind of go outside the box and come up with something new that people don't talk about.
I think one of the more easy steps, but a lot of people tend not to take it, it's just like being more aware and like knowing what's going on and happening today and how we got here, because it hasn't happened overnight. We've just taken a problem and we tried to fix it, but it's kind of just taken on a new form. And with my topic, focusing on the criminal justice system and how it impacts the Black community over time, you can really see this because when the 13th Amendment was ratified in 1865, that was not the end of slavery and racism. Like, it just took on new forms so that people felt like we were moving forward, but we weren't really moving forward. And a lot of it really did have to do with money. When slavery was abolished, it took away a lot of white people's means of making money for their businesses. And right after that, the Black Codes were enacted, which restricted Black people's right to own property, buy and lease land, conduct business, and move freely through public spaces. And a very important part of this was the vacancy laws, which made it so that any Black person who could not prove they worked for a white employer could be arrested. And when I first learned that, I was like, that just doesn't even make sense because we just got rid of slavery and now we're like not allowing Black people to live. And it's just a new form of slavery. And then they created convict leasing, which began in 1866, so also very soon, where prisoners were leased to private railways, mines, and large plantations, which, again, sounds very much like slavery. The prisoners worked with no pay and extremely dangerous conditions where many of them were injured or killed. And you could see that then with following Jim Crow laws and the war on drugs, which increased policing and led to mass incarceration, which upped the amount of bodies in the prison system, which also created money because the prison system is a business. So
right, privatized business, which yes, of course turns around and negatively impacts the ability to live actually in with families in urban areas in particular, where people are taken from their communities and their homes and put in the private prison systems, thus creating a greater burden on particularly women who now are left to run families in pretty rough conditions in these urban areas. The answer being, oh, well, it's okay, we'll send the child to school where they can get a good education, grow up and make something of themselves. And we're right back to where we started.
If I can jump in, I want to go back to what Megan said about, you know, kind of civic participation and getting involved. And money has sort of replaced time when it comes to political participation. So party finances, donations to lobbying groups have skyrocketed as individual participation has dropped. And we've really moved from organizing as collective groups in our communities to donating to groups to do it for us.
Can we touch on that real quick? Civic participation and what that means to everybody? Because I feel like that's something which, given the nature of the education system, tying it back, like you go into ninth grade and the American government class you'll take is very stripped down. It's not very well equipped for actually getting you to become an American citizen who has knowledge of the responsibilities and duties they have to society. So I feel like with that, you have a lot of people who, if they knew what to do or what they could do, they would do it.
If we're recycling the same mistakes over and over and over, if when the citizens see something wrong and they stop it, like slavery, and they say no, but then it comes back in just some other twisted or perverted form, again, the 13th Amendment didn't change anything any more than the 19th Amendment really gave women true equality in this country. And efforts with the Equal Rights Amendment have failed. I mean, how can that fail? And it didn't even fail in Congress. It's failed in states that have refused to ratify it. And so I'd like to understand who looks at, you know, these issues and says, nah, that's not important. It's not necessary.
I feel like one of the problems is you have to realize a lot of people just don't care about being aware because it doesn't impact them. Like, you think about the people in power, but it's not just them, it's us. Like, there's a lot of people with problems that are affecting a lot of our population, but it's not everyone. So the people that's not impacting, they just don't care to learn about or care about or do anything about it in our communities, like Julia was mentioning, because it starts there. And like Carson was mentioning, like, if they're not preparing us to do anything, then why would we know how to do anything? So we don't, and nothing moves forward.
Why might this be the case? Why is it that we don't know, we're not told, we're not given opportunities to make the kinds of changes that we kind of recognize somewhere inside of us? Some of us do, and many, to Megan's point, just don't. If it doesn't impact me, then I don't care. And so Keith found a really, really interesting, I guess, philosophical piece written by a German philosopher, Gunther Anders, who, it's called The Obsolescence of Man, and it was written in 1956, and it's eerie in a lot of ways. So I'm going to let Keith explain that.
I mean, when people think of, like, oppression and suppressing dissent and all that stuff, they usually think of, like, conventional historical stuff, like Nazi troops pulling Jews, you know, out of their houses and, you know, like, direct confrontation. But the easier way to keep people from resisting you is to make it so that the idea of resisting isn't even a realistic possibility. But nowadays, since people are so consistently blinded by dopamine flooding from social media, their phones, you know, drugs, whatever, there's no room to think about your situation. So resisting is no longer an option for most people.
We get so caught up in things we have been doing with the kind of the mentality of, if it's not broke, don't fix it, that we're stuck in these systems and we see that we're stuck, but we kind of just shrug our shoulders and go, eh, maybe it's not too bad.
So just to tie that all together, we have a system that was supposed to represent the people, legislating for the majority while protecting the rights and interests of the minority. But the institutional structures we created to do this were, from the very beginning, designed by the wealthy to benefit the wealthy and maintain the power for the wealthy. The use of egalitarian language, like all men are created equal, and the promise of the American dream, which, by the way, began as a marketing campaign for home construction companies, that kind of language has been used to get citizens to buy into the system. Sure, we start off as equal, and then those who work hard will get to live the dream. But as we pointed out in today's discussion, we do not start off on equal footing with equal protection under the law. And then when citizens point that out and try to find a way around it,
It's just recreated in a different form. So we, the people, don't actually move forward. And instead, we remain trapped by institutional structures and norms and distracted by social media and competitive consumerism. And the one thing that could help us change norms and structures, the notion of universal education, is woefully ill-equipped to do so, mostly because it is a very part of the system that's designed to preserve its own power. We do want to leave you with this. There is hope. Pay attention. Learn. Think critically about what you see and hear. Don't let others make assumptions for you. Don't get distracted. And use social media as a powerful weapon of equal access for all. Thank you for listening today. We hope you walk away from this with a perspective on American democracy that's different than the one you came in with. On behalf of Keith Floyd, Megan Falk, Carson Freeman, Julia Halliwell, and Alyssa Henderson, we extend our deepest gratitude to Paul Chufo and the Hartford Community College radio station for giving us guidance and making our voices heard, as well as Katie Cooney for editing an hour or so of political rant into something listenable. Be well and be an informed voter.